All right. Just want to thank everyone for coming. Welcome to our panel here on viral marketing and Web 2.0. We'll go ahead and get things started. We'll go ahead and do the introductions here. The lady to my left is Gail Z. Martin, and she's going to tell you a little bit about herself and her education and all that kind of stuff.
Well, thanks, Scott. I'm Gail Z. Martin. I write the Chronicles of the Necromancer fantasy adventure series with the Summoner and the Blood King, and coming out in 2009, Darkhaven, from Solaris Books. On the other side of my life, the other day job that I have is I run Dream Spinner Communications, and I have more than 25 years of marketing communications experience. My MBA that I did 22 years ago was in marketing and computers, and at the time, way back in the mid-80s, they heavily discouraged me from combining those because they said, marketing and computers have nothing to do with each other. And I said, go away, you bother me, I like both of them, I'll figure it out at some point. And they did finally intersect. So I come to this both as an author that does a lot of online and viral marketing for my series, and also as a career marketing professional who does a lot of marketing online for my clients.
And I didn't give you my name yet. My name is Scott McGowan. I've been involved in various e-commerce campaigns and over the past 6 or 7 years. Most of my experience has been in the realm of adult entertainment, and I've been basically a professional blogger for a few years. I'm a freelance writer, and right now my most notable project is something called consluts.com. It's not actually what it sounds like. It's basically just a community for people who love cons, and actually they come for the programming and the cosplay and stuff like that, but ultimately they come to party. So that's what I'm doing these days. I'm actually here as more of a moderator than anything. We're missing a panelist due to an emergency that required him to leave town. His name's Jim McAnally, and Jim is an expert in SEO, search engine optimization, and particularly procuring web traffic through search engines, paid and otherwise. So admittedly, we do have a bit of a hole in our content today, but we're going to do the best we can. And I think we've got a lot of good information for you. Two things before we get started. I want to map out just a couple of things, one of which is the format. We're going to take probably about the first 15 or 20 minutes and go through some terms and definitions and things like that. And we'll try to blow through that as quick as we can and get into the meat and potatoes of things. And also just to give you an idea of the goals. The goals of this is basically to give a rudimentary understanding of how to use tools that you probably already use in one way or another to market your own crafts or yourself if you're a performer or something of the sort. This is a really kind of a 101 class. We're not going to get into really heavy technical stuff, but this is basically just to help you open your eyes to what's already there and what's already at your fingertips, and most likely in a very inexpensive way as well. And after we get through with this, basically I'm going to basically be interviewing Gail for you guys a little bit and guiding the conversation. And after that, we'll definitely open things up for Q&A. So let's get into it. Of course, you wouldn't be here if you didn't know the title. We'll define viral marketing first. It's essentially the idea of viral marketing is simply to expand your brand awareness utilizing various medias and distribution methods. Now, this incorporates a lot of different web applications and websites, as well as different types of medias, whether that is text, images, video, what have you. And the distribution methods, of course, these are email, social networks, blogs, whether they're community blogs like LiveJournal or standalones under a single URL, as well as audio and video sharing like YouTube and message forums. Web 2.0 is kind of a nebulous term. It's really more of a buzzword than anything, and I kind of accept this to be a hollow word, actually. The term derives from O'Reilly Media, and they put on basically trade show types of things for various multimedia companies, and education is really their thing. And it became the name of a conference, the Web 2.0 conference. It refers to sites that primarily deal with user-created content and really heavily promotes interactivity between users. Now, this is also progressive, but nothing new, in the sense that, you know, elements of Web 2.0, communities and interactivity and users submitted content has been around forever. You know, you go back to the the bulletin board systems. It was there. It was just rudimentary and very basic and simple. Okay, so we're going to go into some examples of Web 2.0 sites and applications. Social networking obviously is the kind of the 800-pound gorilla of all of this, especially with MySpace. How many people here have a MySpace account? Really? Everybody, for all intents and purposes. If you don't have one on MySpace, you probably have one somewhere else, especially something like LinkedIn, which is a professional community, Facebook. And these are the big mammoth guys, and they tend to incorporate a lot of different elements of Web 2.0 under one kind of catch-all roof and website, including forums and messaging and being able to make your own web page and a friend system and that kind of thing. Next is blog networks. These are communities like LiveJournal and Blogspot. And they really heavily rely on the friend system so that you can add friends and read their journals daily or their blogs daily, and they can read yours. It also relies heavily on filters so that you can filter out professional things from personal things and other such contacts. Standalone blogs are basically when you buy a URL, you buy a domain, and you put a blog up there, and it kind of personalizes things a little bit more, but you don't get the built-in eyeballs that you would with a blog network necessarily. And these often deal with individual subjects rather than kind of the broad daily, this is what I did during my day. These are usually about certain topics that you are passionate about as opposed to your normal day-to-day life. Media sharing like YouTube, iTunes, there's a lot of free stuff there. It's not all paid, obviously. And these sites focus on audio and video. This, of course, YouTube is another 800-pound gorilla in the room. Probably the best way for a novice to share video with the world. Wikis is another example. We've all seen Wikipedia. Basically, this is user-submitted information, and it's text in nature. Search engines love this. They gobble wikis. They just love it. The drawback here, though, is because it's user-submitted content on subjects, you tend to get into a lot of false information as well. So they have to be heavily moderated a lot of times, which is a big task. Link sites like Drudge Report, FARC, utilize user-submitted news often. And though Matt Drudge from Drudge Report, he really takes care of the site himself, but he does rely on a lot of incoming stuff. FARC is a traffic monster. If you've ever been to that site, it's FARC.com. If you can get a link on FARC, you're probably going to blow up your server. This is the kind of thing you're dealing with, but it's great stuff. But there is a high level of interactivity on sites like FARC as well because of commenting and the like. Consumer review sites is another example of Web 2.0 because it really relies heavily on user-submitted information, of course. There's also a community feel to it, people who specialize in reviewing certain products because they buy them often, tend to get to know each other's reviews and things like that, and it becomes a very important tool in being able to market products. If you know you have something good, you really want these folks to review it. this often as well gets focused on niches in one way or the other. There are too many to list out, but if you get on websites like travel websites that deal with hotels and airlines and things like that, restaurants, they tend to get very focused. Everything and nothing, this is just kind of a catch-all term that somebody I think I know came up with. These are sites like the Old Consumption Junction, and they utilize various platforms, media sharing and forums and blogs and the whole nine. But usually these are entertainment-oriented websites where you show up and you watch funny videos and read a blog by a staff member, and then the discussion starts. An example of viral marketing is, I'm going to give you one here, and I think it's probably the most ingenious piece of viral marketing I've ever seen, so I wanted to use this. This is a two-minute Honda advertisement from 2003. Basically, they built a Rube Goldberg machine out of parts from a Honda. If you've never seen this, I think you're going to be in for a treat. The branding on this was excellent. You never walked away from this, and forget the fact that you just watched a Honda commercial. It's just cool. You know, the greatest things that you'll find out there in terms of viral marketing just make you go, whoa, that's cool. It's not, you don't realize you're dealing with a marketing message. It's a totally different approach because it was intended for internet audiences. It's two minutes long. So it was really a groundbreaking piece of viral marketing. It still gets comments on the YouTubes and of the world and the other ones. The day that I pulled this up and downloaded it, this one had 5 comments that day and had been uploaded for years. Another question here, are there two viral messages here? And the answer, I think you can probably already tell the answer is yes. So we're going to go ahead and just play this for a second and let you see this. So that's my example of viral marketing done perfectly. this is just one of those things that still gets replicated over and over and over to this day and sent around in emails. And it's just brilliant. Okay. All right. Other terms of interest. These are various, they kind of come from all over, and I think I've got just a couple of pages of this, and then we'll move on. A newsletter, this is a very common. When you sign up to a website, a lot of times they'll ask, can we send you a newsletter? And this is actually a very powerful tool in marketing your products. Of course, the difference between a newsletter and spam is that a newsletter is opted in by the user, whereas spam is completely unsolicited and illegal. These are just marketing messages, as you know, that are sent through various platforms, including now mobile telephones and instant messengers. It's really a big mess. One thing I do want to make mention about spam, for those of you who may not know, the reason you still get spam, even though it's illegal, is because it is very, very lucrative. Therein lies the problem. Even though their conversion rate with, let's just say, a spam email, it's not really about percentage, the percentage of people who click on it. It's about pure bulk. So if you only get maybe 0.5% or 0.33% of people that actually click this message, this is amazing, big-time bulk traffic. And that's why it's still done today, even though it's extremely unethical and illegal. Search engine optimization. Essentially, this is improving your traffic basically by utilizing search terms in your headers and your text in various ways, and basically making your site attractive to search engines. Keyword-rich text is kind of a segment of SEO, and this is basically the practice of fitting the words like puzzle pieces in certain orders and using the correct terms within text, say on a blog or some other form of heavy text like a wiki, that makes it more attractive to a search engine. Keyword stuffing is an old term. It really doesn't work very well anymore, but it's basically the practice of just kind of throwing a bunch of keywords onto a page. For instance, at the very bottom of the page, throwing in a bunch of unrelated text. Like, say, you're running a soft weapons LARP website, and you put all this stuff about Lindsay Lohan at the bottom of the page in text that's the same color as the background, as a means to try to attract traffic. It doesn't really work anymore. The search engines have gotten pretty hip to it, and now they don't recognize it as much, but people still do it. But it really is frowned upon. It's really just nasty kind of stuff. So that's the end of the slideshow. So we can go ahead and bring up the lights again, and we'll finish up with this. And what we're going to move on into now is basically we're going to do a little interview with Gail. And so I guess the first question is, and I always like to get this out of the way first when I'm doing this. It might be a bit embarrassing. Tell us about one of the biggest mistakes that you made when you first started out, especially in the modern era. What was one of the big mistakes that you made that you just kicked yourself afterwards?
I think that I didn't build out one of my websites as fully from the get-go. It took me too long.
Okay.
And I lost time. So I created a site in a way that was difficult to upgrade frequently, difficult for me to update. And it's all about fresh content. And so if you have your site created in a format that you can't get it frequently updated or you can't do the updates yourself, you're losing precious time and the site will start sinking in the rankings, whether or not you started out at a decent position or not, because it's all about fresh content. So I would say not making it that way from the get-go.
And one thing that I can interject, and it's a similar mistake that people make that I've seen in the past, and I've even been guilty of this as well, is that it's a lot easier to build your website right the first time instead of going back and having to retrofit various pieces. I've seen a lot of people shoot themselves in the foot that way. So tell me about, let's talk about when you really got started, when you really got started doing this. When you were obviously ahead of the curve when it came to the idea of combining the computer and computer networks, what did you see in it that others didn't, and how did that manifest itself later on down the line?
Well, I think that, you know, it strikes me as kind of odd that even today, even in the science fiction community, where theoretically we're supposed to be the people with the eye on the future and the crystal balls that work, there's still a reticence among a lot of writers to embrace the technology. It's almost nostalgia. I don't know what it is. You know, they gave up their quill pens, but they're still reticent about doing the marketing. And I think the thing that excites me the most about it is that it enables you to reach truly a global market in near real time from your kitchen table. And I mean, Gutenberg never had it this good. So just the sheer scope and the ability for interactivity is what really excited me. So once, as I said, I write the Chronicles of the Necromancer series, it's really an international project because my publisher, Solaris Books, is located in Nottingham, England. I'm here in the States. I've got readers all over the world. And I started looking at it saying, I can only physically get so many places in a year. I have other obligations as well and cost considerations. So how can I connect in a quality way to my readers regardless of where they are? And that was really what got me very excited about what can I create with my website, how can I make this as live as possible. So I started the Ghost in the Machine podcast. You can find the Ghost in the Machine fantasy podcast on my site, on iTunes. After this week, it should be up just about everywhere else. And we've been going now for about 18 months with that. I interview other authors. And the great thing about that is that was conceived of as a viral marketing technique from the beginning, because I do the podcast. Not only does it upload to places like iTunes into the podcast directory since available through our RSS, but I share the code with the people who are on the program. So then they have an incentive to post it themselves, to pass it along to their readers, to share the code in an easy way to embed it. And the whole goal is, if you enjoyed this podcast, pass along the code. So it's viral from the get-go and incredibly inexpensive to do.
Indeed.
So that's what I love about it, is coming from a traditional training in advertising and looking at the standard ad rates to run any kind of media campaign, you know, Super Bowl ads, radio spots, and then I look at what's possible to do with a little bit of creativity and elbow grease with viral marketing, the return on investment just doesn't even compare.
Indeed. Let's get into social networking.
Okay.
This is kind of a boon and a bane for a lot of people in using the MySpaces of the world and Facebook. Tell us a little bit about the positive parts of utilizing social networks, the really big ones, as well as some of the drawbacks.
Well, I started out with the books on MySpace, and since then I've added Facebook and Squidoo, and community-wise I'm on Shelfari and bookmarketing.ning and BookTours. I think I'm leaving a couple out somewhere. I have a blog. I also am on Amapedia, and I'm in Amapedia and Wikipedia, and my blog is on my Amazon profile page. And I have just found that the social media piece is a great way to connect with people who you might not have otherwise crossed paths with, but you share a common interest. And if you've heard the whole term around the long tail, the idea, it's a very popular buzzword right now in marketing. If you think about a comet, the fireball of a comet is what you think about, but the long tail has a great deal of matter and particulate pieces in it, and the internet now makes it possible and profitable to focus on that long tail. So now you can create and profitably promote things that don't have to appeal to the mass market, and your niche market can find you more efficiently and effectively than any other time in history. So for me, social media is all about capitalizing on that long tail and getting to meet people who have self-selected to be in groups on Facebook or MySpace about a love of books or science fiction and fantasy, getting involved in conversations, responding to forum threads, inviting friends to come and join the groups that I've started, which, if you're interested in books and book marketing, I've got a group on Facebook and would love to have you join me. Sorry, couldn't resist the plug.
No, it's fine. Let's talk about kind of the drawbacks, or at least one of the drawbacks that I believe that I've witnessed in the past, and that is when you're getting onto social networking sites and you're starting out, getting that initial few people to start creating your web of sorts. And when I say a few people, I'm not, I'm talking a couple of hundred, just to kind of get things moving. How do you do that without, just running around and adding people indiscriminately? And how do you find your audience out there?
Well, I was already blogging, and I already had a newsletter to my established readership, mm-hmm. so I let them know that I had posted a MySpace page, and please come over and friend me.
Mm-hmm.
And so people that I knew in real life did, and readers who knew me through the books did. I enjoy going out to the different groups on Facebook and MySpace and reading the forum posts and responding to them and looking for people who have chosen to express their interest in a topic and inviting them over to my place and saying, hey, it looks like we share a love of books. I have a group over here I think you might find interesting. It's got some cool content. Please come over and check it out. Would love to have you join me. And I think done selectively to people that you really do see a common affinity with, it's no different than walking up to somebody here at the con that you don't know and say, you know, this could be strange, but I bet you're here because you like to read science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And have you ever read this book? And starting up a conversation.
Right. Let's talk about getting into blog networks and such. LiveJournal is very popular, has been for now, probably, I guess, about 8 years, where it seems like, almost like MySpace, seems like everybody's got one. Let's talk about blog networks. How important are those with your having large friends lists, and how often do you need to create content for something on a blog network?
Well, I think with blogging, it really is about fresh content posted regularly. So at a minimum, something fresh every week, mm-hmm. and preferably, you know, even more than that. And with my blog, it's not just video, it's not just audio, text. I also upload my podcast mm-hmm. through the same RSS feed. I video blog at all the conventions that I appear at. I'm video blogging from Dragon Con, so I'll mash that together and post it and then embed the link in my blog and you'll be able to read it there. So that keeps it fresh. Okay. It's really about a dialogue.
Right.
But I think the other thing to think about is you don't have to get massive numbers for something to be effective. It goes back to the fallacy of the keyword stuffing. And
right.
You know, getting, if you have a website about, you know, science fiction and fantasy, running all kinds of words about Lindsay Lohan at the bottom is not going to bring you qualified traffic. Not only that, but not only will the people not be interested in what you've got on the blog once they get there, they'll be pissed off that you took them there.
Right.
So then they'll flame you and then they'll post nasty things other places. But why would you want to attract people who aren't even interested in what you have to sell or what you have to say? The key is to get qualified traffic.
Right.
Whether you're trying to sell a product or share an idea, you want people who care about it. You don't want people who just, you know, got hijacked. And so it isn't necessarily about huge numbers. It's about the right numbers.
Right. In terms of keyword stuffing, one thing that I'll make mention of is the reason that this became a popular thing was in the early days of affiliate marketing and advertising, where the amount of hits or unique visits that your site gets is the most important thing. Tracking then was pretty lousy a lot of times, and you know, people are a little more hip to web advertising now. So the reason they did that was just so they drive their numbers up and say, well, we have, you know, X amount of thousand you know, unique hits per day. You need to advertise on our website or sponsor us or what have you.
So if you filled the analogy with broadcast media would be if you filled an entire warehouse with radios and turned them all on and there were no human beings in there listening, wow, wouldn't your program get a lot of listenership?
Exactly.
There are radios tuned to it. Yeah, but nobody's listening.
Nobody's listening, and that's the problem. But, you know, if you can use that as a scam to, you know, get somebody to pay you $300 a month to advertise on a website, well, granted, their marketing message is going nowhere, but you've got $300 in your pocket. That's where the scam comes from.
It's the equivalent of print magazines that print a gazillion copies, but how many people actually get it?
How many
of those copies end up in a dumpster? Well, they can say that they printed 100,000 copies, but, you know, a human being may have actually looked at 2,000 of those. So, yeah, it comes down to knowing what you're talking about when you actually buy your media.
And one other thing on that topic that I'd like to bring up is that when it comes to traffic and measuring your traffic, tons and tons of unique hits is great, but really what you're looking for is what we call sticky traffic. Mm-hmm. People who come to the site and stick around. You know, they read more than one page. So what we're really talking about is page views. When we're talking about sticky traffic, we're talking about repeat traffic, and we're talking about multiple page views per visit. And right now, that is mostly the most attractive thing to potential sponsors or advertisers for a web-based kind of business. Let's go into actual personal messaging in some sort, and that includes newsletters, mm-hmm. that includes bulletins and things like that on various social media sites, or just individual messages that may go out on a blog network or something mm-hmm. like that. How often do you need to contact your audience personally, and how much is too much?
I think that depends a lot on your audience and what it is you're trying to do. I mean, I see a lot of people experimenting right now with Twitter.
Right.
And, you know, there is a limit to which I want to know when people that I am in a network with, you know, sneeze, wipe their nose. I'm drinking my Diet Coke now. I really don't give a flying rat's patootie. So I think you can wear out your welcome very, very quickly
right.
if you aren't saying something relevant and innovative, because we're all really busy here. So I think that's one of those where the new is going to wear off
You're
really
right.
quickly. I think if you are giving people relevant content that they care about, relevant as defined by them,
right,
something that either entertains them or informs them or gives them some kind of tool that they can use right now today in their life or in their business, then they will put up with the interruption.
Mm-hmm.
But the real key here is to be an invited guest and not a door-to-door salesman banging on the door.
Right.
So to the traditional way of marketing was to interrupt the heck out of somebody until they finally gave in and bought your product. And we have shown advertisers as a society what we think of that by not watching broadcast media anymore. Everybody's watching cable or downloading the shows they want from the internet or getting them on Netflix or putting them on their podcast on their iPod, so they don't have to put up with the commercials because we didn't like being interrupted.
Right.
The same thing's happening with broadcast radio. Now they're either tuning into Sirius and some of the channels that don't have the kind of advertising, or they're just pulling it down on the iPod and you don't have to put up with it at all.
Right.
So interrupting is no longer working as a method of advertising. Now it really is based on relevancy and relationships. And if you have a relationship with somebody, it wears out pretty quickly unless you're adding value.
Okay. Let's talk about content for a second in terms of the marketing messages that you're sending out. Let's talk about some mistakes that people make out there when they're actually, you know, sending out the content or putting it out there. What are some of the big mistakes that people, what are the no-nos when it comes to content?
Well, I think one of the biggest things is pushing out there what you want to tell people as opposed to what your audience actually cares about. So that's where understanding why is your audience? What is it that you gave them in the first place that made them pause and give you their attention? And you want to give them more of that. It's not about listing a bunch of features. It's about talking about the benefit as defined by them. So I think the number one thing is pushing out content that the user doesn't consider to be relevant and therefore becomes spam.
Okay. Let's see, as far as content is concerned, what is really most important as far as, well, okay, let's get into this. When you're putting out your messages, how important is it to make sure that everything is correct? You know, no grammar errors, you know, that kind of, how important is that? Is it important at all?
I think it's important, and it also depends on whether you are doing this as a hobby and just for fun, or whether you're really doing this as part of a professional push.
Right.
Obviously, if this is part of something that you have a business interest in and you want people to see you as a qualified professional, spelling things counts.
Mm-hmm.
Capitalizing counts. Punctuation still counts. Having said that, you know, everybody misses something sooner mm-hmm. or later. If it's just for fun, people will probably forgive you a little bit, but you'll also still look less intelligent.
Right.
But it also comes down to how important the content is,
mm-hmm.
because if the content is spot on and giving them exactly what they want, either in entertainment value or in quality of life, they're more willing to forgive you for it not being perfect.
Okay. As an artist, it's kind of overwhelming because you are also marketing sometimes not just the product, but you're also marketing yourself. One of the things that people end up doing sometimes is kind of losing their own identity in their own marketing messages. So let's talk a little bit about how to market your product, but not always pushing yourself to the forefront, and how do you make that separation between this huge audience of people that know who you are, but you don't necessarily know who they are sometimes, at least in a personal sense. How do you separate that and keep your privacy?
Well, I think you don't talk about things you don't want to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
I never talk in any detail at all about my kids because I find that I'm uncomfortable sharing that with the world because I don't know who's out there and I'm a protective parent. So I will mention that I have kids, but I will not show their pictures.
Right.
They're not in any of my video blogs from the cons. My daughter went on book tour with me last year and I didn't show her in any of the pictures. So you don't talk about the things you don't want to talk about. You
right.
have a right to do that. I think one of the ways that you also help to keep it from just being about you is to embrace a concept of collaborative marketing, which mm-hmm. is very much at the heart of the internet ethos, and the whole history of the internet is sharing. And I'm not talking about unscrupulous sharing or disregard of copyright, but mm-hmm. I'm talking about finding other people to collaborate with who are also speaking to the same audience and then reinforcing each other's messages. For example, with my podcast and my video blog, I'm video blogging and interviewing other writers, artists, ghost hunters, other people in the science fiction, fantasy, paranormal space. When they're on my podcast, they're getting free publicity.
Right.
When they post my podcast on their site to their opt-in list, I'm getting free publicity. We are ultimately helping out both of our readerships because I've now introduced my readers to another writer that I think does a good job, and hey, they're going to read more than one book a year. So after they're done with my book, they've got a bunch of other books they're going to read this year. How about reading my friend's book? It's good. And vice versa. So that, I think, also helps keep it fresh because then I'm not always the one in the spotlight. I want to introduce you to a friend of mine, and they're going to talk to you today. And we swap guest blogs, and they're the ones whose faces in the video blog, and it's their voice on the podcast. So it's not always about me. And I love to talk about other people's stuff and share that with my readers, and I find that it works well in reverse, so it's a win-win for everybody.
Let's talk about branding and, mm-hmm. and of sort. During the Honda commercial, I asked if there were two viral messages in there. I'm sure you noticed that at the very beginning of it, you saw a watermark for www.stupidvideos.us. So yes, there were two viral messages there. How important is it to brand every piece of media, a video blog, an audio blog, to make sure that you have the branding somewhere in there so that when it does replicate itself on a YouTube or what have you, that people will eventually trace it back to the original creator?
Well, I think it's essential because if people can't trace it back to the original creator, you may have created art, but you haven't done marketing.
Mm-hmm.
And so if your goal is to get more traffic for your own sites, get more readers, get more listeners, whatever your product or service, even if it's the sharing of ideas is, you want people to be able to follow the breadcrumbs back to where the source is. So, yeah, I think branding is absolutely essential. There are a huge number of blogs and more added every day. There's a growing number of podcasts. There's a growing number of video blogs. There's a lot of clutter.
Right.
And so branding helps people remember what they saw and who it belonged to.
Gotcha. I'm going to go ahead and let you guys start guiding the conversation a bit. So if we have questions, this is where we'll go ahead and start doing that. And I want to encourage a lot of interactivity here. I think you went up first.
A lot of content creators on the internet have had success with letting their readers or watchers derive or remix mm-hmm. their content, like with Creative Commons licenses. Do you have experience with this and any recommendations for things like that?
Yeah, I was really excited when I saw some of the new stuff that Cory Doctorow is doing.
That's exactly the person I was thinking about.
Yeah. Cory is taking a flyer on that, which I think is exciting. And if you're not familiar, Cory's a well-established science fiction author. And he's also the brains behind BoingBoing.net, which is one of the most visited blogs on the internet. And Cory has now opened up some of his very early writing and redone it under a Creative Commons license, which allows people to mix and match and mod up it but they can't then create commercial content out of it. They can't take his stuff, switch it around, and then sell it. I think that goes to the heart of fan fiction. I mean, fan fiction has been doing this forever. Back, when I was in high school, I ran a fan fiction e-zine, and that was back before we could put it on the internet because the internet was just being invented. And I think that goes to the heart of the science fiction community. We've been doing that forever. So I think it's very important, and I think that's a great source of new ideas. There is a terrific book out there. I think the writer is Matt Sloan, called The Pirate's Dilemma, How Youth Culture is Changing Capitalism. And I never thought that I would see a book that would manage to get Sid Vicious and economics in the same sentence. but from punk to grunge to hip-hop, all the way through the music scene, through video game modding, this guy makes the case that the real soul of inspiration is and always has been taking something that somebody else created and tweaking it and twisting it and putting your own spin on it, all the way back even to in the American colonies when people would bring over the latest English fashions and furniture, take it apart, reverse engineer it, put it back together again, and sell their own versions. So he's not encouraging theft, but he is encouraging creative borrowing. Excellent book.
I have one back there. Yeah.
Did you say you were on Ning?
Yeah, bookmarket.ning.com.
Well, I had a question about it.
Yeah.
I had to read an article in a class about how the people at Ning consider their website a double viral loop, partially with the users being created and then also the networks that are being created from each other. And I was just wondering, because when I went onto the site for the paper that I had to write, it seemed like there are a lot of communities and stuff that are dead, and it's kind of a little confusing about navigating and everything. So I was just wondering how that's working for you. Because I think it's a fascinating concept.
The site that I'm on, I didn't create. I joined someone else's site and created a profile page. And you bring up a really good point about all social networking is it is time intensive. In fact, I have a couple of virtual assistants who help me post content and keep the sites, you know, cleaned up. I you know, write the content and I write the blog entries, but they help me post it just because it does take a tremendous amount of time. Now, for a business person, it doesn't take any more time than showing up to all those rubber chicken lunches where you exchange business cards with people. And it's a lot more fun. And you reach a much broader audience, but it is time intensive. And I think a lot of people get in there and they start blogs and they create communities in this burst of optimism. And then they find out, oh, not only is this work, but I may not see any noticeable return on investment for like, you know, a year. Podcasting is a minimum of a year or two before you really build the audience and get noticed. And they tell you, don't even get into it if you're not willing to put at least a year into it. So thanks. That's a great point.
Yeah. I mean, there are people that I know that literally do this kind of stuff for a living, mm-hmm. You know, even if it's, like you said, just, you know, being an assistant or a publicity consultant or something like that. I know folks that they make help people create content, but they're the ones that are, you know, putting feet to pavement on all the websites to make sure that the information is disseminated.
Yeah, we have a question over here.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's good that you said something about the publicist. Do you have a traditional old school publicist right now?
I am a traditional old school publicist.
That's my question. Where is that industry at as far as viral new marketing goes with the internet?
Well, you know, it's kind of fun because I also teach PR writing for University of North Carolina at Charlotte. And I take my PR writing class a completely different way than a lot of my colleagues because I'm out there doing it. And so my kids are reading The New Rules of PR by David Meerman Scott, and they're reading books on blogging, and they're reading books on, and they're downloading people's ebooks because by the time it goes through the traditional publishing loop, it's outdated. And we spend a lot of time on the web. The PR industry is in, part of it's in denial, and part of it doesn't know what hit it. And I think publishing is there as well because the internet has changed things so fast, so radically, that it's not about running a Super Bowl ad anymore. You know, the Mentos and Diet Coke YouTube video blew the idea of running a Super Bowl ad away. And there are an awful lot of practitioners who had no idea how to play with this. So if you are looking to hire somebody in the PR realm to help you, make sure they understand the way things are actually working today, which is not about running ads in your local newspaper.
Got one in the back there. Yeah, blue shirt. Yeah.
Okay. This is more of a comment. I have a music podcast, and because of that, I have PR companies emailing me dozens. Most important thing for me is that they make it easy for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, I have 5 seconds to look, and I'm like, I have to have an MP3 I can play. If you don't give me something to play, I can't use it. There's one company that does this very well.
And I bet they get picked up by you a lot more than everybody else.
I use them a lot. Almost every time I use them. And there's another company
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, not only do you bring up a great point, which is if you're the one pitching, you have 10 seconds or less.
Don't make me work.
Yeah, you have 10 seconds or less to get the attention of the reporter or the blogger. The reporter or blogger is there for two reasons. They inform or entertain their listenership. If you can't help them inform or entertain, they have no reason to help you. They're not there to promote your business. And if you can make it easy for them to cut and paste, you help them keep their quota and meet their requirements of getting enough content to fill their vehicle. If not, they'll go to the next person who does make it easy. You do. You do. And so you want to make yours as cut and paste friendly as possible. Yeah.
I'm not very tech savvy right now. How can I learn how to do this sort of stuff? I mean, now I know where to go and websites and stuff like that. Do you recommend any books, any kind of websites that I can learn how to do podcasting, how to do, I know they have a whole podcasting track here, but.
Well, and it's great. I know a lot of the folks on the podcasting track, and they do a great job with it. There are books out there. I think T. Morris has a book on podcasting. There are books on video blogging. The only thing you have to realize is by the time something actually goes through the traditional publishing cycle to come out in a book, it's already a year and a half old, which is like forever ago on the internet. Go out to communities, download articles, go where the podcasts are and look for the how-to articles. I actually use some very, very simple technology. I use a program called Audio Acrobat. It's about $20 a month for a subscription, and I can create my podcasts via a conference call, and it does all the formatting and uploads it directly to iTunes, and for my videos, uploads it, you know, to YouTube and puts an RSS feed on it, and then it gives me a variety of different formats that I can use. So you don't have to actually get into the nuts and bolts of connecting the wires if you don't want to. There are a lot of different ways around it.
And I would like to say on that topic, don't be afraid of it. When I first got into, I'm not really a tech-savvy guy myself, but when I first got into the e-commerce industry, it took me a couple of days of training on the job, and I was able to just start playing with things myself and figure it out. So don't be afraid and ask questions. That's the big thing. There are people out there that want to help you because that's what they're into as well.
If you are sincerely interested in something and you ask politely, you'd be amazed at what people will tell you. I got into video blogging with this little baby. It's a $200 flip cam. It's a flip cam because the USB connector flips right out of the side. It's loaded with the software you already need to put together video clips and upload them. It doesn't get any easier than this, and you too can be on YouTube.
And, you know, one thing I'll tell you is just go out and find a free video editing software. I can't think of the one that I use
the
right off
the top
of my
head. The audio editing one is Audacity that everybody uses.
Okay, yeah, that's one that I have as well. Just sit around and play with it for a little while, and you'll be amazed at what you're doing in just a matter of a couple of hours.
Most of the stuff is very user-friendly now, and it doesn't require you to be a total tech geek to make it work.
Yeah. One in the back. Yep.
I have a question. The old adage is about how nobody wants to hear your own personal story because everybody out there is blathering about theirs. How do you balance that if you want to do something that is a blog that's kind of lifestyle related about like the scene or BDSM or that kind of thing?
I know that the adage out there is that nobody wants to hear your story, but I go out there and I see an awful lot of people with very large readerships talking about what they had for breakfast this morning, and you know, especially I see a lot of things on the parenting networks where it's all about the perils and pitfalls of dealing with a two-year-old, and you know, anybody who's ever had one has had exactly those kind of days, and yet they're getting 10,000, you know, 20,000, 50,000 people listening to them about it. So I think it all comes to telling it in an interesting and relevant way. Telling it with some kind of takeaway that the person who reads it is going to identify with or feel vindicated or validated, or at least feel like they've connected, as opposed to telling it because you want to be famous?
I would also add to that just very quickly, to be honest, you know, there's the old adage of write what you know. And, you know, if you're really involved in something, it'll come through. Just be honest. And that doesn't mean you have to give out, you know, tons of information, you know, about your personal life, you know, your credit card numbers or whatever. But be honest. And people really gravitate towards that from what I've seen, especially with blogging.
Transparency, authenticity, and a sincere desire to connect, as well as passion, will come through in your writing, and people will be attracted to that.
Thank you.
Yeah. I think we had a corpse gray hand in the back.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I work at an environmental nonprofit here in Atlanta, and my supervisor is the PR marketing person, and the development, because she has a lot on her plate. I'm the IT coordinator. How should I convince her that we should start doing the 2.0 things? Because I suggested that we have, you know, we look at some sites that would be good for us to get on, or some things that would be good for us to get interested, and do a whole marketing plan so we can, like, kind of appear, you know, on the internet instead of just doing random, you know, have some kind of plan. But it is going to be a lot of work. And so I suggested farming it out to our constituents, because, you know, there's a lot of people who are green, and they're very vocal, and they're, you know, the advocates. So do you have any other suggestions for me to get her on the vote?
Well, I think the biggest thing is you need to use Web 2.0 because it fulfills valid points on your marketing plan. You don't use Web 2.0 just because you want to use Web 2.0. So there has to be a reason to do it via those tools as opposed to other tools. One of the things that a lot of people in PR and in management are scared to death about Web 2.0 is they perceive it as a loss of control. You know, the traditional PR control freak wants to know every reporter's name who calls and be able to log how many press kits we sent out this month. And if you make your press kit downloadable off the internet, you can still track, but you're no longer controlling it. And my point, and I speak a lot on PR techniques for business, is that if you don't have your message on the internet, you have already lost control of your message, because somebody else is positioning you, and reporters and other people who are looking for your voice can't find it, and so they'll listen to somebody else talk about you. So you've already lost control of the message if you're not out there. So I think that may be a selling point. Whether or not you can let your constituents help you build the site is going to depend a lot on that. Will take moderation so that somebody doesn't, you know, put something up there that gets you in hot water. That does take a good deal of moderation.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. It sounds like she would want to start with some kind of pilot project, something really small.
That was going to be my only suggestion, is to say play with it and show the results. You don't necessarily have to do it for your company. You can do it, you know, on the side, just to kind of say, okay, well, this is what I brought in with this small project. And if you have numbers, numbers always, you know, impresses even the old school, you know. We'll take in the back. We'll move forward. Yeah.
Going back to Audacity, she uses Propaganda right now to do her podcast, and we tried using Audacity to replace Propaganda, and it was horrible. I hate that software. How did you guys make it work?
Audacity reminds me of what I used to have to pay an audio engineer big bucks for 20 years ago when he had, you know, proprietary computer programs. So I guess perhaps it's just a very familiar model for me because I'm used to doing it an even harder way.
There was a checkbox that you could do multiple sources.
Yeah, you can do multiple sources. You can do a lot of things.
That's not going to matter what
Yeah, and I use Audacity to edit something that I recorded in a completely different format. I don't record in Audacity. I use it as the editing software.
Yeah.
I actually record in Audacity, so I'll play.
Okay, we got a question right here, black shirt.
Actually, this question might be more for Scott because you talked about e-commerce.
Okay.
Okay, I'm involved in the e-commerce business right now.
Okay.
Right now, most of our traffic is coming from paid keywords on the site.
Right.
Like in search engines.
Certainly.
So, the thing is, one thing that we've been trying to do is paying bloggers to review our products.
Right.
Is that legit?
I have seen, I wouldn't go that far, to be honest with you. I wouldn't pay anyone, because it does look shady. But I think it's a great idea to approach bloggers and give them a product and say, we want your honest point of view on this.
Let's say we send it out to them and just don't hear back from them. Does that happen a lot of times?
Yeah, it's a gamble that, I mean, what's your product, for instance, that you guys are?
Let's say, for example, we're selling this, you know, let's say we're selling this new thermometer.
Okay.
And we want them to review and see how fast it can get the temperature, right? And we're just asking, you know, here's some questions that we want you to talk about, some talking points.
Right.
And then here's the product, and we want to hear back from you about it.
Well, I can tell you that, you know, because you really don't want to get into signing contracts with people or anything like that, because it's really I will tell you this, though. You will always have more traffic coming from your paid stuff. If you're doing it right, you will always have more traffic coming from your paid stuff, no matter what. But I would say that you let the bloggers come to you instead of approaching them with an email or something. Hey, we'd like you to review this product for us. Have a link on your website and, you know, invite bloggers to come to you about it. And if they're really interested in the product that you have, then they'll come to you.
Well, and I guess I would say, I wouldn't so much try to put the words in their mouth and tell them what the talking points are. Why don't you see if they'll interview you about your industry, and then you can talk about your product as a tangent to that. But it goes back to that inform and entertain thing. There are a lot of ways to get your product and yourself and your company covered without having that be the central focus, and usually sharing information and collaborating on content is a little more legitimate than just outright, here's what we'd like you to say about us.
And you can usually tell who's legit and who's not. Mm-hmm. If you do your homework. You know, just some guy with a blog, eh. But there are a lot of people out there that these are people that update every day, 2 to 3 times a day, with, you know, 500 to 1,000 words. These are people that are dedicated to what they're doing. So that's something you need to look for as well. Make sure that the person that you're approaching really, really does their job as a blogger. Otherwise, there's no point in having the word out there. So,
there's a big emphasis on podcasting and video. Is there anything you can say about the importance of those multimedia and the quality of that multimedia?
I think that human beings take in information in more than one way, and some people prefer one form over another. So some people will prefer to read something. Other people are more visual or audio learners. And when you use multimedia, not only are you giving people choice of receiving the information in the way that is the most meaningful for them, but you also kick up the novelty. You're not just reading something that's static. You're watching something or you're listening to something, and that makes it even more interesting. Some of the best corporate PR sites that I've seen include snippets from both audio and video, and it makes it so much more interesting to watch somebody give, you know, 2 minutes out of a speech than to read the speech excerpt.
I would also say that it's very important when it comes to especially audio and video. Search engines can't read a video and pick up on. So you have to tag. You have to have accurate descriptions. This is another place where people try to keyword stuff. I don't know if you've noticed this. People love to try to keyword stuff, the descriptions and tags on the videos that they upload. Don't do that, but make very accurate descriptions of what's going on with the proper keywords, because you're more likely to get eyes to that video, and then your message goes through. In the back, all the way in the back.
Earlier you had mentioned that traditional marketing people really like to keep control over things like press kits and stuff. I come from a software background. I have completely zero understanding of this. Can you explain a bit why people might want to restrict access? For example, I had a client want me to put a sign-up form on their website to read a white paper, which was just marketing their product. Buy our enterprise software, but they want you to sign up before you can read it.
Yeah.
Why on earth would anyone want to do that?
Well, some people are just plain paranoid. Lots of people don't understand how the web works. But in old line traditional marketing, PR people help to validate why their department was important and why people should keep paying their salaries by being able to pull out and say, but look, we responded to 25 media inquiries this week, and who would have sent those out if we hadn't been here? And look, we got so many column inches worth of newspaper coverage, and you just are darn lucky we were here to get that for you. So it was a way of validating that your continued corporate existence, you know, should continue. They're afraid of having some people are by nature information hoarders. They don't understand how to share the information. I think we've all worked with someone like that. And it's just not in their nature to understand that sharing the information leads to a bigger pie for everybody. You're right. People aren't going to buy your product if they don't know what it is, and they're not going to sign up until they know.
This lady, young lady, says she's got a split, so I'm going to get her next. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say I work in...
Oh, okay.
And that's considered a lead source. They want to turn that over to sales and marketing.
But there are ways of capturing that information and tracking it that don't discourage the person. Because what we're finding with opt-ins, you know, the rage was to try to get everybody to sign in everything they could, and people just said, screw you, I'm not going to do it. So then they tried to put just the name and the email address, and now the folks who are really out there on the edge of doing a lot of internet marketing, the Alex Mendosians and the Michael Ports and the Armin Morins and all those guys, are saying, you know what, soft works better. Just ask for their email address for an ethical bribe item that they really want. They'll give you their email address, but, you know, even just asking their name cuts response 30%.
We had one over here.
Well, yeah, that was something about using a virtual assistant earlier. Get content you created and distributed. I'm wondering, are there any online tools that you can use to take the content that you created and put it up on different sites or whatever?
There may be. Anytime you get into any kind of blaster software, you run a real risk of annoying people. So that's where I still like using a human being who can reason and make theoretically rational decisions to do it. Well, you know, RSS does that on one level in terms of automatically updating content. But where I use a virtual assistant is, I'll write posts and then have that person help me put the information out there, upload videos, upload audios that in formats that don't lend themselves to RSS. And I'm not aware of anything in those particular places that would have automated it for me.
I have very, I'm not an SEO guy, but this is one thing that I've heard. When it comes to putting stuff all over and on different websites and things of the sort, it does help to change, basically duplicate entries sometimes hurt your credibility on search engines. So if you've got six different sites that all say the same thing, they just kind of go, oh, well, this is just some kind of garbage, and it starts kicking it down in the rankings. So be very careful when it comes to duplicate stuff like that. Try to switch things up a bit if you can. Right here.
You were mentioning a couple of questions ago about the importance of tagging your information, making it easy to index. To extend that a little more, do you have experience with making, say, podcasts accessible, say, providing transcripts for deaf readers, or listeners, I should say, while you're not listening for deaf? But do you have experience with stuff like that, and do you think it's important or something that should be encouraged more in the community?
I think that you need to kind of let your own listenership or readership guide you with that. For some of the marketing related information that I do create transcripts and ebooks based on podcasts, and you know, some people tell you that they really prefer it that way, and other people would really rather listen. So I think it depends on your particular readership's interests.
5 minutes? Okay. We got time for a couple more questions if we have them. I guess.
Follow up on that. There's a podcast that I subscribe to, and what they did, they didn't have the time. You know, it's obviously time consuming to create a transcript, particularly if it's not a scripted podcast to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
They threw it out to their community. They put a wiki up and said, well, you guys have told us you want a transcript, and so jump into the wiki and transcribe a couple minutes, and other people will do the other parts, and eventually we'll have a full transcript. And they were bribing them with, little giveaways and T-shirts,
right,
and like that. And lo and behold, people stepped up, and they've got transcripts for all their podcasts.
And I think when it comes to that kind of thing, diversity is key. You know, doing just a podcast, okay, you can do it, but it helps if you're getting your message out in various ways, like she does. You know, once you pigeonhole yourself, you know, it's tough to kind of get out of that, because people will come and then forget and then just move on. So at least that's been my experience. Those are some of the mistakes I've made, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? One in the back.
Wow.
I had trouble hearing that last bit. I'm sorry.
Can you?
So beyond having a good website with brand, good content that's updated,
mm-hmm.
and a Facebook and some of the other, are there other places that you suggest to distribute information?
Well, you know, I don't think that the traditional press release is dead by any means. You need to have a targeted media list, whether that's online or offline, and you need to be able to send out a well-written release that is targeted to user need with a good solid headline, because you know you've got less than 10 seconds to get their information. But whether you're sending that out to websites and blogs within the interest community, or whether you're sending them out to geographically relevant or interest relevant hard publications, that's definitely still a viable tool. It's just some of the old rules have changed about it, and PR is much more direct to consumer now. So where it used to be that we sent out press releases hoping and begging a reporter who was the gatekeeper to run the information, because otherwise we had no way of getting to the ultimate reader, now regular people do their Google searches to find their own information, and the media has been disintermediated. So when you write your press releases, don't just write them to reporters. Write them with the ultimate consumer in mind, and then post them on some of the online press release distribution sites so that people who go and Google conventions in Nebraska can find you.
I would also advise utilizing various types of forums, mm-hmm. especially that are really relevant to the type of convention it is. Is it a gaming convention or is it... Okay, it's gaming convention. Okay. There are tons of forums out there that deal specifically with gaming, even down to very small niche type of games and things like that. So if let's just say you cater to a very small niche of gamers and you have a tournament that someone else doesn't have or it very rarely see, this is where you use that niche-oriented content to get involved with a forum and let people know that way. Forums are great with search engines. We personally use vBulletin on our website because it's just the search engines love it. And I would also encourage user interactivity on the website, your own website as well. Make sure that people know that there is an incentive for coming not just to the website, but staying on the site and, you know, discussing things on forums or something like that. Anytime that you can bring people in and have them stick around for longer than 2 minutes, you're doing something right, and that's very important.
Well, and the one caveat I'd add to that on forums is it is an absolute no-no to go out and post a blatant advertisement as a forum post. You want to make a relevant contribution to the discussion thread, and that's where empowering some of your other volunteers or even your diehard rabid congoers to say, hey, can you help us out here? When you're out there doing what you normally do anyhow on these forums and you're posting about something you love, can you mention us and say, you know, wow, I had a really good time doing that at the convention in Nebraska?
We've got about 1 minute, so we're going to do last question here, and we'll finish it up.
Just wanted to get your thoughts on how do you start actually measuring the level of engagement that you start getting. You've done a good job of being able to actually get traffic funneled to your site or to your meeting. How do you start actually?
Well, there are a lot of different ways. I mean, there's a free tool, Google Analytics, which it's really interesting. Not that long ago when I was in corporate, we would have had to pay a minimum of six figures to get the functionality that you get for free in Google Analytics. So that's just mind-blowing to me. But that will help you measure web traffic, stickiness, country of origin, top referring sites, quite a few other things. You can take a look at if you have a forum or you have a discussion if you have a discussion post out there and nobody's posting, you're not getting much interactivity. Take a look at your, you know, Google yourself. See where you are. Find out how many people refer to you. How cross-linked are you? How many other people think that what you have to say is important enough to post a link or mention you? So there are a lot of different ways just by looking at, you know, beyond how much traffic comes to the site, how much are people interacting with you? How many, if you're on MySpace, how many times do people friend you or comment or post on your blog? And understand that probably 90% of people lurk, and there's only a vocal 10% that is doing all the posting. It doesn't mean you're not getting traffic, but you're looking for engagement.
And I would add only to look at something like Alexa.com. That's just like the name Alex with an A at the end of it, Alexa.com. And just compare yourself with other similar sites, you know, that work in the same genre and that kind of thing. I would not say it is a 100% reliable tool by any stretch of the imagination, but you can get a kind of a gauge, and I think that's worth something.
Well, I think the thing you got to remember with web marketing or with traditional marketing, 100 years ago, the Philadelphia department store genius John Wanamaker said, I know that 50% of my marketing is wasted, I just don't know which 50%. And we have all kinds of cool new tools, but we still don't always know which 50%.
I would also add, you know, anytime, like for instance, as far as attracting sticky traffic to a forum where people want to post, give them an incentive. You know, if they get something cool after, you know, they've made 50 posts or something like that, it works. And most people are actually polite enough not to just bump threads and just be a complete jerk. If you give someone a reason to come in, then it starts rolling.
And that reason can be as simple as recognition.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, I participate quite a bit on the marketingprofs.com website, and if somebody throws out marketing questions and self-appointed experts answer their questions, and they get to reward the best answers with points. And there's a little ranking on the right-hand side that tells who has the most points. And so, you know, all of us keep investing professional time where we could be billing hours answering these free questions to get points. You know, it's like giving cookies.
All right, I think that's going to have to do it for us. I want to thank everybody a bunch for coming. Hope you have a great con.
It was fun.
Yeah.